Stark knew my preference, though of course she didn't. Only Columbo could have figured that out. I swallow and take a couple of sips of the bitter coffee. "Delightful," I say. Detective Stark guffaws. I do believe it is a proper guffaw. No other word would suffice. She crosses her arms. This could mean she's cold, but I doubt it. She distrusts me, and the feeling is entirely mutual.
"You realize we've laid charges against you," she says. "For unlawful possession of a firearm, for possession of drugs, and for first-degree murder."
I nearly choke on my next sip of coffee. "That's impossible," I say. "I have never hurt a soul in my life, never mind murdered one."
"Look," she says, "we believe you killed Mr. Black, or you had something to do with it, or you know who did. The autopsy report has come in. It's definitive, Molly. It wasn't a heart attack. He was asphyxiated. That's how he died."
I jam another chunk of muffin into my mouth and concentrate on chewing. It's always good to chew every bite 10 to 20 times. Gran used to say it aids digestion. I begin counting in my head.
"How many pillows do you leave on every bed that you make up at the hotel?" Detective Stark asks.
I know the answer, obviously, but my mouth is full. It would be impolite to reply right now.
"Four,"
the detective says before I'm ready to answer. "Four pillows are on every bed. I verified it with Mr. Snow and some of the other maids. But there were only three pillows on Mr. Black's bed when I arrived at the scene of the crime."
"Where did the fourth pillow go, Molly?"
6, 7, 8 chews. I swallow and am about to speak, but before I do, the detective slams both hands down on the table that divides us, which causes me to nearly jump out of my chair.
"Molly," she barks, "I just insinuated that you murdered a man in cold blood with a pillow, and you're sitting there mindfully eating a muffin."
I pause to regulate my pulse, which is racing. I'm not used to being yelled at or accused of heinous crimes. I find it most disconcerting. I sip my coffee to settle my jangling nerves. Then I speak. "I will say it in a new way, Detective. I did not kill Mr. Black, and I most certainly didn't asphyxiate him with a pillow. And for the record, there is no possible way that I could ever possess drugs. I've never seen nor tried one in my life. Also, they killed my mother, and very nearly killed my gran of a broken heart."
"You lied to us, Molly, about your connection to Giselle. She told us you often hung around the Black Suite long after you were done cleaning it, and that you engaged in personal conversations with her. She also said you took money from Mr. Black's wallet."
"What? That's not what she meant. She meant took as in accepted. She gave the money to me." I look from the detective to the camera blinking in the corner of the room. "Giselle always tipped me generously and freely. It was she who took bills from Mr. Black's wallet, not me." Detective Stark's mouth is a hard line. I straighten my pajamas and sit taller in my chair.
"After everything I've said, that's the one point you want to clarify?"
The straight angles of the room begin to warp and bend. I take a deep breath to steady myself, waiting until the table has corners instead of curves. It's too much information. I can't process it all. Why can't people just say what they mean? I gather the detective has spoken to Giselle again, but it's impossible to believe that Giselle misrepresented me. She wouldn't do such a thing, not to a friend. A tremor starts in my hands and travels up my body. I reach for the styrofoam cup and almost spill it in my haste to bring it to my lips. I make a quick decision. "I do have one clarification to make," I say. "It is true that Giselle confided in me and that I considered her a friend. I am sorry for not making this entirely clear to you before." Detective Stark nods.
"Not making this entirely clear? Huh. Is there anything else you decided to not make entirely clear?"
"Yes, in fact there is. My gran always said that if you don't have anything nice to say about someone, it's best to say nothing at all, which is why I said little about Mr. Black himself. I'll have you know that Mr. Black was far from the fine VIP that everyone seems to think he was. Perhaps you should investigate his enemies. I told you before that Giselle was physically harmed by him. He was a very dangerous man.
Dangerous enough for you to tell Giselle that she'd be better off without him?
But I stop right there, because I did say this. I remember now. I believed it then, and I believe it still. I fill my mouth with a chunk of muffin. It's a relief to have a legitimate reason not to speak. I return to Gran's chewing imperative. 1, 2, 3.
Molly, we've spoken with many of your co-workers. Do you know how they describe you?
I pause my regimen to shake my head.
They say you're awkward, standoffish, meticulous, a neat freak, a weirdo, and worse.
I reach 10 chews and swallow, but it does nothing to alleviate the lump that has formed in my throat.
Do you know what else some of your colleagues said about you? They said they could totally picture you murdering someone.
Cheryl, of course. Only she would say such a heinous thing. I don't like speaking ill of people, I reply, but since you're pressing me, Cheryl Green, head maid, cleans sinks with her toilet rag. That's not a euphemism. I mean it literally. She calls in sick when she's well. She spies into people's lockers, and she steals tips. If she's capable of theft and hygiene crimes, how low would she go?
How low would you go, Molly? You stole Mr. Black's wedding ring and pawned it.
What? I say. I didn't steal it. I found it. Who told you that?
Cheryl followed you all the way to the pawn shop. She knew you were up to something. We found the ring in the front window, Molly. The shopkeeper described you perfectly. Someone who blends into the background until she speaks. The kind of person you'd easily forget about under most circumstances.
My pulse is pounding. I can't keep my mind focused. This doesn't reflect well on my character, and I must make amends. I should not have pawned that ring, I say. I applied the wrong rule in my head, the finder's keeper's rule, when I should have applied the do unto others rule. I regret that choice, but it doesn't make me a thief.
You've stolen other things, she says.
I have not, I say, punctuating my disdain with crossed arms, a postural signal of indignance.
Mr. Snow has seen you stealing food from discarded trays, and small pots of jam.
I feel the floor of my stomach drop out from under me, the way it does when the elevator at the hotel is about to go on the fritz. I'm not sure what's more humiliating, that Mr. Snow saw me do this, or that he never said a word to me about it. He is telling the truth. I admit. I have liberated discarded food, food that would have ended up in the trash bin anyway. This is waste not, want not. It is not theft.
It's all a matter of degrees, Molly. One of your colleagues, a fellow maid, says she worries that you can't spot danger.
Sunitha, I say. For the record, she's an excellent maid. It's not her record that's on the line here. Did you speak with Mr. Preston? I ask. He will vouch for me.
We did speak to the doorman, actually. He said you were blameless. Interesting choice of words. And that we should dig for dirt elsewhere. He mentioned Black's family members as well as some strange characters coming and going at night. But it was like he was going out of his way to protect you, Molly. He knows something isn't right in the state of Denmark.
What does Denmark have to do with any of this? I ask.
Detective Stark sighs loudly. Bloody hell. It's going to be a long day.
And Juan Manuel, the dishwasher? I ask. Did you talk to him?
Why would we talk to a dishwasher, Molly? Who is he, anyhow?
A son to a mother, a provider to a family, another invisible worker bee in the hive. But I decide not to press further. The last thing I want is for him to be in trouble. Instead, I name the one person who I'm certain would vouch for my reliability. Have you spoken with Rodney, the bartender at the social?
As a matter of fact, I have. He said he thought you were, quote-unquote, more than capable of murder.
All of the energy that has kept my spine upright dissipates in an instant. I slump over and look down at my hands in my lap. A maid's hands. Working hands. Chafed and dry, despite all the lotion I put on them. The nails cut cleanly short, calluses on the palms. The hands of a much older woman than I actually am. Who would want these hands and the body attached to them? How could I ever think that Rodney would? If I look up at Detective Stark now, I know the tears will spill from my eyes, so I concentrate on the cheery little teapots on my pajamas. Vibrant pink, baby blue, and daffodil yellow. When the detective speaks, her voice is softer than before.
Your fingerprints were all over the Black Suite.
Of course they were, I say. I cleaned that suite every day.
And did you also clean Mr. Black's neck? Because traces of your cleaning solution were found there, too.
Because I checked his pulse before calling for help.
You had various plans for killing him, Molly. So why in the end did you choose asphyxiation rather than the gun? Did you really think you wouldn't get caught?
I will not look up. I will not.
We found the weapon in your vacuum cleaner.
I feel my insides twisting, the dragon slashing and gnashing. What were you doing meddling with my vacuum cleaner?
What were you doing hiding a gun in it, Molly?
My pulse is pounding. The only other person who knew about both the ring and the gun was Rodney. I can't do it. I can't assemble the pieces in my mind.
We tested your housekeeping cart, Detective Stark says, and it tested positive for traces of cocaine. We know you're not the kingpin here, Molly. You're simply not smart enough for that. We believe that Giselle introduced you to Mr. Black and that she groomed you to work for her husband. We believe you and Mr. Black were well acquainted, and that you were helping him hide the lucrative drug operation he was running through the hotel. Something must have gone wrong between the two of you. Maybe you got angry with him, and you retaliated by taking his life. Or maybe you were helping Giselle get out of a bad situation. Either way, you were involved. So, as I said, this can go one of two ways. You can plead guilty immediately to all charges, including first-degree murder. The judge will take your swift guilty plea and confession into consideration. An early demonstration of regret, plus any information you can provide about the drug running happening in this hotel, could go a long way in lightening your sentence.
The teapots dance around in my lap. The detective is droning on, but her voice sounds tinny, farther and farther away.
Or, we can do this the long and slow way. We can gather more evidence, and we can end up in court. Either way, Molly the maid, the jig is up. So what do you choose?
I know I'm not thinking straight, and I don't know the proper rules of etiquette when one is accused of murder. Out of nowhere, I remember Columbo. You read me my rights earlier, I say, at the door of my home. You said I have the right to consult an attorney. If I hire one, do I have to pay immediately? Detective Stark rolls her eyes. Exasperation writ so large that I can't miss it.
Lawyers generally don't expect cash on the spot, she says.
I hold my head up and look straight at her. In that case, I'd like one phone call, please. I demand to speak to a lawyer. Detective Stark pushes back her chair. It makes an aggravating noise. I'm certain she's just added to the plethora of unsightly scuff marks already on the floor. She opens the door of the interrogation room and says something to the young police officer standing guard outside. He fishes a cell phone from his back pocket and hands it to her. It's my cell phone. What is he doing with my cell phone?
Here, the detective says.
She drops my phone on the table with a clunk. You took my phone, I say. Who gave you the right? Detective Stark's eyes go wide.
You did, she says. After you fainted in the cell, you insisted that we take your phone in case you needed it later to call a friend.
The truth is that I don't remember, but something vague niggles at the back of my consciousness. Thank you very much, I say. I pick up my phone and press contacts. I search all 8 entries. Giselle, Gran, Cheryl Green, Olive Garden, Mr. Preston, Rodney, Mr. Rosso, Mr. Snow. I consider who is truly on my side, and who might not be. The names swirl before my eyes. I wait until I can see clearly. Then I choose and dial. I hear it ringing. Someone picks up. Mr. Preston, I say.
Molly, are you all right?
Please pardon me for troubling you at such an inconvenient hour. You're probably getting ready for work.
Not now. I'm working the late shift today. Dear girl, what's going on?
I look around the plain white room with the fluorescent lights beating down on me. Detective Stark eyes me with her ice-glazed stare. The truth is, Mr. Preston, I'm not quite all right. I've been arrested for murder. And more. I'm being held at the station nearest the hotel. And I hate to say this, but I could really use your help.
Chapter 16. Once I finish my call to Mr. Preston, Detective Stark holds out her hand. In truth, I do not know what for, so I grab my empty styrofoam cup and pass it to her, thinking we are finished and that she's cleaning the table.
Are you kidding me? She says. Now you think I'm your maid?
I most certainly do not. If she were anywhere near a half-decent maid, this room would not look as it does, scuffed and scratched, stained and smeared. If I had so much as a napkin and a bottle of water, I could bide my time cleaning up this pig pen.
Detective Stark takes my phone from my hand. Will I get that back? I have essential contacts that I'd hate to lose.
You'll get it back, she says. Someday.
She looks at her watch.
So, is there anything else you'd like to say while we're waiting for your lawyer?
My apologies, Detective. Please don't take my silence personally. First off, I've never been very gifted with small talk, and when I'm forced to make it, I often say the wrong thing. Second, I'm aware of my right to remain silent, and so I'll begin employing it immediately.
Fine, she says. Have it your way.
After what seems like an unholy eternity, there's a loud knock on the door.
This should be interesting,
Detective Stark says, rising from her chair and opening the door. It's Mr. Preston, in civilian dress. I've rarely seen him out of his doorman's cap and coat. He's wearing a perfectly pressed blue shirt and dark jeans. There's a woman with him dressed much more formally in a tailored navy suit, carrying a black leather briefcase. Her short, curly hair is perfectly coiffed. Her dark brown eyes immediately give away who she is because they're so much like her father's. I stand to greet them. Mr. Preston, I say, barely able to contain my relief at seeing them. I move a bit too quickly and hit my hip bone on the table. It smarts, but it doesn't stop the surge of words that flows from my mouth. I'm so glad you're here. Thank you so much for coming. It's just that I've been accused of some terrible things. I've never harmed anyone, never touched a drug in my life, and the only time I've ever held a weapon was...
Molly, I'm Charlotte, Mr. Preston's daughter says, interrupting me. It's my professional advice that you remain silent at this time. Oh, and it's very nice to meet you. My dad has told me a lot about you.
One of you better be an attorney, or I'm going to lose it, Detective Stark says.
Charlotte steps forward, her sharp heels clacking loudly on the cold industrial floor.
That would be me, Charlotte Preston, of Billings, Preston, and Garcia, she says, flicking a business card to the detective.
Dear girl, Mr. Preston says to me, we're here now, so don't you worry about a thing. This is all just a big...
Dad, Charlotte says.
Sorry,
he replies and zips his mouth shut. Molly, do you agree to be represented by me?
I don't say a word.
Molly, she prods.
You instructed me not to speak. Should I speak now?
My apologies. I wasn't clear. You can speak, just not anything relating to the charges, Lane. Let me ask you again.
Do you agree to be represented by me? Oh, yes, that would be most helpful, I say. Can we discuss a payment plan at a more convenient time? Mr. Preston coughs into his hand. I'd offer you a tissue, Mr. Preston, but I'm afraid I don't have one on me. I eye Detective Stark, who is shaking her head.
Please don't worry about payment right now. Let's just concentrate on getting you out of here, Charlotte says. You realize that to release her, you've got to post bail of $800,000. Now let me see, Detective Stark says as she puts her index finger to her lips. I think that's just a spot above a maid's earnings and assets, am I right?
You're right, Detective, Charlotte says. Maids and doormen are often underpaid and undervalued, but litigators, we do all right. Better than detectives, so I'm told. I've personally posted bail with the clerk out front. She smiles at Detective Stark. I can say with 100% certainty that it's not a friendly smile. Charlotte turns to me. Molly, she says, I've arranged for you to have a bail hearing later this morning. I'm not allowed to represent you there, but I've filed some letters already on your behalf.
Letters? I ask.
Yes, from my father, who has provided a character statement, and from me, saying I'll post your bail. If all goes well, you'll be released this afternoon.
Really? I ask. Is it that simple? I'll be released and this will be over?
I look from her to Mr. Preston.
Hardly, Detective Stark says. Even if they get you off now, you'll still have to stand trial. It's not like we're dropping the charges.
Is that your phone? Charlotte asks me.
Yes, I say.
You'll make sure it's kept locked and safe somewhere, right, Detective? You won't be logging that as evidence.
Detective Stark pauses. Her hand is on her hip.
It's not my first rodeo, cowgirl. I've got her house keys, too, by the way, which she insisted I keep after she passed out.
The detective fishes my keys from her pocket and drops them on the table. If I had an antiseptic wipe, I'd snatch them up and immediately disinfect them.
Great, Charlotte says, picking up my keys and phone. We'll talk to your clerk out front and make sure they log these as personal possessions, not evidence.
Fine, says Detective Stark.
Mr. Preston is looking down at me, his eyebrows crinkling together. It may be that he's concentrating hard, but I think it's more likely that he's concerned.
Don't worry, he says. We'll be waiting for you after the hearing.
See you on the other side, Charlotte adds. And with that, they turn and leave. Once they're gone, Detective Stark just stands there, arms crossed, glaring at me. What happens now? I ask. I'm finding it hard to breathe.
You and your teapots go back to your charming holding cell and wait patiently for your hearing,
Detective Stark replies. I stand and straighten my pajamas. The young officer outside is ready to escort me back to the repugnant cell.
Thank you very much, I say to the detective before I exit.
Thank you for what? She asks.
For the muffin and the coffee. I do hope you have a more pleasant morning than mine.
Chapter 17. It feels awfully strange to be wearing pajamas in the afternoon, and it feels particularly unnerving to be in a courthouse wearing such wholly inappropriate attire. One of Detective Stark's police officers kindly drove me to this courthouse about an hour ago, and now I'm seated in a cramped office on the premises with a very young man who will serve as my attorney in the bail hearing. He asked me my name, reviewed the charges against me, told me we'd be called into the courtroom when the judge was ready, and then claimed he had some emails to read. He took out his phone and has been giving it his fullest attention for at least 5 minutes. I have no idea what I'm supposed to do in the meantime. No matter. This allows me time to collect myself. I know from TV that as the accused, I should be wearing a clean blouse, buttoned to the neck, and formal dress slacks. I most certainly should not be wearing pajamas.
Excuse me, I say to the young attorney, would it be possible to go home and change before the hearing?
His face scrunches up.
You can't be serious, he replies. Do you know how lucky you are to be seen today?
I am serious, I say. Quite.
He puts his phone in his breast pocket.
Wow, do I have some news for you.
Excellent. Please share it, post haste, I reply. But he doesn't utter a word. He just stares at me with his mouth open, which surely means I've made some blunder, but what it is I do not know. Moments later, he proceeds to fire questions my way.
Have you ever done jail time?
Not until this morning, I say.
That wasn't jail, he says. Jail's way worse than that. Do you have a criminal record?
My record is squeaky clean, thank you very much.
Do you harbor plans of leaving the country?
Oh, yes. I'd love to visit the Cayman Islands someday. I've heard it's lovely. Have you been?
Just tell the judge you have no plans of leaving the country, he says.
As you wish.
The hearing won't take long. They're pretty standard, even in criminal cases like yours. I'll try to get you free on bail. I'm assuming that, like everyone else who's ever been accused, you're not guilty and you want out on bail because you're the sole caregiver for your poor, sick grandmother, right?
I was, but not anymore, I say. She's dead. And I'm not guilty on any of the charges, of course.
Right. Of course, he replies.
I'm grateful for his instant vote of confidence. I'm about to get into the details of my complete innocence, but his phone buzzes in his pocket.
We're up, he says. Let's go.
He leads me out of the small office, down a hallway, and into a much larger room with benches on both sides and a wide aisle in the middle. I'm walking down the aisle with him to the front of the courtroom. For a moment, I imagine a similar room, with a similar aisle, with a big difference that in my imagination, I'm walking down the aisle as a bride-to-be, and the man beside me is not this stranger at all, but a man very known to me. My flight of fancy is rudely interrupted when my young attorney says,
"Take a seat,"
and points to a chair in front of a table to the right of the judge. As I sit, Detective Stark walks into court and seats herself at an identical chair in front of an identical table across the chasm of the aisle. I feel my jitters return. I clasp my hands tightly in my lap to quell my trembling. Someone says, "All rise," and I feel the young attorney's hand on my elbow guiding me to my feet. The presiding judge emerges from a door at the back of the court and plods to his high bench, sitting down in front of it with an audible groan. I do not mean it unkindly when I say that he reminds me of a Brazilian horned frog. Gran and I watched a tremendous documentary about the Amazon rainforest and the Brazilian horned frog. Such a unique creature. It has a long, downturned mouth and protuberant eyebrows, much like the judge before me. The proceedings begin immediately, with the judge asking Detective Stark to speak. She presents the charges against me. She says many things about the Black case and about my involvement in it. She makes it seem like I'm not a reliable person, but it's the end of her diatribe that stings the most.
"Your Honor," she says, "the charges against Molly Gray are very serious, and while I'm aware that the accused before you presents as a picture of innocence and not a flight risk at all, she has proven herself unreliable. Much like the Regency Grand Hotel where she works, which by all appearances is a fine, upstanding hotel, the more we probe into the life of Molly and her workplace, the more dirt we uncover."
If I could, and it were my place to do so, I'd bang a gavel and yell, "Objection!" just like they do on TV. The judge doesn't move at all, but he does interrupt.
"Detective Stark, may I remind you that the hotel is not the subject of this hearing, nor can a hotel stand trial. Can you please get to the point?"
Detective Stark clears her throat.
"The point is that we are beginning to question the nature of the connection between Molly Gray and Mr. Black. We've gathered significant evidence of illegal activity between Mr. Black and the seemingly innocent young hotel maid you see before you. I'm deeply concerned about her moral integrity and her ability to abide by the rule of law. In other words, Your Honor, this is a prime example of appearances being deceiving."
I find this incredibly insulting. I may have my faults, but it's balderdash and poppycock to suggest that I don't follow rules. I've devoted my entire life to just that, even when the rules are entirely unsuited to my constitution. The young attorney is directed to speak on my behalf. He talks quickly and flails his arms dramatically. He explains to the judge that I have a squeaky clean criminal record, that I lead a woefully uneventful life, am gainfully employed in a menial position offering zero flight risk, that I have never in all my years left the country and have occupied the same address for 25 years, ergo, my entire life. In closing, he poses a question.
Does this young woman really fit the profile for a dangerous criminal and a runner? I mean, really. Take a good look at who you have in front of you. Something doesn't add up.
The judge's frog-like jowls are resting on his hands. His eyes are droopy and half-closed.
Who's posting bail?
He asks.
An acquaintance of the accused, the young attorney answers.
The judge checks a paper in front of him.
Charlotte Preston.
The judge's eyes open slightly and fall on me.
Friends in high places, I see,
he says. Not usually, Your Honor, I answer, but lately, yes. Also, I wish to apologize for my wholly inappropriate attire. I was arrested at my front door at an inopportune hour of the early morning and was not afforded a chance to dress in a respectful manner that befits your court. I don't know if I was supposed to speak, but it's too late now. My young attorney's mouth is wide open, but he's giving me no clues as to what I should do or say. After a sizable pause, the judge speaks.
We won't judge you on the basis of your teapots, Miss Gray, but on your propensity to obey the rules and to stay put.
His impressive eyebrows undulate to accentuate his words. That's welcome news, Your Honor. I'm actually quite gifted when it comes to obeying rules.
Good to know, he replies.
The young attorney remains completely quiet. Since he's not venturing a word in my defense, I carry on. Your Honor, I consider myself most fortunate to have made a couple of friends several rungs above my station, but I'm just a maid, you see. A hotel maid. A wrongly accused one.
You're not standing trial today, Miss Gray. You understand that if we grant you bail, your movements will be restricted. Home, work, and the city only.
That accurately summarizes my circumnavigations up to this point in my life, Your Honor, minus travel and nature documentaries on TV, which I'm assuming don't count since they occur from the relative comfort of an armchair. I have no intention nor financial ability to expand my geographic reach, nor would I know how to go about travel all on my own. I'd be worried I wouldn't know the rules in a foreign place, and that I'd make a fool of myself. I pause, then realize my faux pas. Your Honor, I add hastily, with a quick curtsy. One side of the judge's long amphibious mouth curls up into something resembling a smile.
I'd hate for anyone here today to be making a fool of themselves, the judge says.
Then he looks at Detective Stark, who for the first time in the proceedings does not meet his eye.
Miss Gray, the judge pronounces, I hereby grant you your conditional bail. You're free to go.
Chapter 18. At long last, after many forms and formalities, I find myself sinking into the plush leather back seat of Charlotte Preston's luxury car. Once I left the courthouse, I was passed off to a clerk who said she knew Charlotte well and would bring me safely to her. She escorted me to a back door where Mr. Preston and his daughter, as they had promised, were waiting for me. They whisked me away in this car. I am free. For now, at least. The dashboard of Charlotte's car tells me it's 1 p.m. I believe this vehicle is a Mercedes, but given that I've never owned a car myself and only ride in them on rare occasions, I'm not up on the finer brands. Mr. Preston sits in the passenger seat while Charlotte drives. I'm tremendously grateful to be in this car rather than in court or in the filthy basement holding cell in the police station. I suppose I should focus on the bright side, rather than on the unpleasantness. This day has afforded me many new experiences, and Gran used to say that new experiences open doors that lead to personal growth. I'm not sure that I've enjoyed the doors that have opened today, nor the experiences I've had, but but I do hope they lead to personal growth in the long run.
Dad, you have Molly's phone and keys, right?
Oh, yes, Mr. Preston says. Thank you for reminding me.
He removes them from his pocket and passes them back to me. Thank you, Mr. Preston, I say. Only then does it occur to me. May I ask where we're going?
To your home, Molly, Charlotte said. We're going to take you home.
Mr. Preston turns around in the passenger seat to meet my eye.
Now, don't you worry, Molly, he says. Charlotte's going to help you out. Pro bono, and we won't stop until everything's back to normal. Tickety-boo.
But what about the bail? I ask. I don't have anywhere near that kind of money.
That's okay, Molly, Charlotte says, never taking her eyes off the road. I don't actually have to pay that, only if you run away.
Well, I'm not about to do that, I say, leaning into the space between the two front seats.
Sounds like old Judge White figured that out fairly quickly, or so I'm told, Charlotte says.
How did you hear that so fast? Mr. Preston asks.
The clerks, the assistants, the court reporters, people talk. Treat them well and they give you the inside scoop. Most attorneys walk all over them, though.
The way of the world, Mr. Preston says.
I'm afraid so. They also said Judge White was in no rush to release Molly's name to the press. Sounds to me like he knows Stark's chasing the wrong fox.
I don't know how any of this could have happened, I say. I'm just a maid, trying to do my job to the best of my abilities. I'm not guilty of any of these charges.
We know that, Molly, Mr. Preston says.
Sometimes life isn't fair, Charlotte adds. And if there's one thing I've learned over years of practice, it's that there's no shortage of criminals out there who will prey on a person's difference for their personal gain.
Mr. Preston turns around in his seat again to look at me. Deep wrinkles have emerged on his forehead.
Life must be hard without your Gran, he says. I know you relied on her a lot. You know, she asked me to look out for you before she passed.
Did she? I say. How I wish she were here. I look out the window through the tears that have formed in my eyes. Thank you for looking out for me, I say.
That's quite all right, Mr. Preston replies.
My building comes into view, and I'm fairly certain that I've never been happier to see it. Do you think it's appropriate for me to go to work today as usual, Mr. Preston?
Charlotte turns to her dad, then looks back to the road ahead.
I'm afraid not, Molly. It will be expected that you take some time off, Mr. Preston says.
Would it not be correct to call Mr. Snow?
No, not in this case. It's best right now not to contact anyone at the hotel.
There's visitors parking at the back of my building, I say. I've never used it, as the visitors Gran and I used to receive were mostly Gran's friends and none of them had vehicles. Do you keep in touch with them? Charlotte asks as she turns into a free spot.
No, I reply. Not since Gran died.
Once we're parked, we get out of the car and I lead the way into the building. This way, I say, pointing to the stairwell.
No elevator?
Charlotte asks.
I'm afraid not, I reply.
We climb silently to my floor and are walking down the hall toward my apartment when Mr. Rosso emerges from his.
You, he says, pointing a plump index finger at me. You brought the police into this building. They arrested you. Molly, you're no good, and you can't live here anymore. I'm evicting you. You hear me?
Before I can answer, I feel a hand on my arm. Charlotte steps past me and stands a few inches from Mr. Rosso's face.
You're the slumlord, I mean landlord, I suppose.
Mr. Rosso pouts the way he always does when I tell him I'm going to be a bit late with the rent.
I am the landlord, he says. Who the hell are you?
I'm Molly's lawyer, Charlotte replies. You do realize that this building is in violation of more than a few codes and bylaws, right? Cracked fire door, parking too tightly spaced, and any residential building over 5 stories has to have a working elevator.
Too expensive, Mr. Rosso says.
I'm sure city inspectors have heard that excuse before. Let me offer you some free legal advice. What's your name again?
It's Mr. Rosso, I offer helpfully.
Thank you, Molly, Charlotte replies. I'll remember that.
She turns back to him.
So the free advice is, don't think about my client. Don't talk about my client. Don't harass or threaten my client with eviction or anything else. Until you hear differently from me, she's got a right to be here, the same as anyone else. You got it? Clear?
Mr. Rosso's face has turned bright red. I expect him to speak, but surprisingly he does not. He merely nods, then backs away into his apartment, quietly closing the door behind him. Mr. Preston smiles at Charlotte.
That's my girl, he says.
I fumble for my keys and unlock my apartment door. One of the great virtues of Grand's daily cleaning regimen is that the apartment is in a perpetually suitable state to receive unexpected visitors, not that I usually receive any. Besides the unwanted visit from police earlier today and the shocking visit from Giselle on Tuesday, this is one of the few times I'm able to reap the benefits of this advantage. Please come in, I say, directing Charlotte and Mr. Preston through my front door. I don't take the polishing cloth out of my closet because I'm still in slippers and they have spongy bottoms that can't effectively be wiped. Instead, I grab a plastic bag from the closet and wrap my slippers in it. TBSL, to be sanitized later. Mr. Preston and Charlotte elect to keep their shoes on, which is fine by me, given how grateful I am to them at this particular juncture in time. May I take your bag? I ask Charlotte. The closets are small, but I'm a bit of a wizard when it comes to spatial organization.
Actually, I'm going to need it, she says, to take notes.
Of course, I say, though I feel the floors tilt under me as I realize what she's here for and what's about to happen next. Up to now, I've been concentrating on the new delight of having people, friendly people, helpful people, in my environs. I've tried to ignore the fact that very soon, I'll have to think more deeply about all that has happened to me today and leading up to today. I'll have to share details and recount things I don't actually want to think about. I'll have to explain all that has gone wrong. I'll have to choose what to say. No sooner have I had these thoughts than I visibly begin to shake.
Molly, Mr. Preston says, putting a hand on my shoulder, would it be all right if I went into the kitchen and prepared us all a pot of tea? Charlotte will tell you. I'm very good at it. For a big old lug, anyhow.
Charlotte strolls into the living room.
He makes a mean cuppa, my daddy does, she says. Leave that to him, and you can go freshen up, Molly. I'm sure you're eager to change.
I most certainly am, I say, looking down at my pajamas. I won't take long.
There's no rush. We'll be here when you're ready.
I can hear Mr. Preston clanging around in the kitchen and humming to himself while I'm out here in the hall. This is most certainly a breach of proper etiquette. The guests should be seated comfortably in the sitting room, and I should be tending to them, not the other way around. And yet, the truth of the matter is, I can't follow protocols in this very moment. I can barely think straight. My nerves are too frayed. While I stand, immobilized in my own hallway, Charlotte joins Mr. Preston in my kitchen. They chatter back and forth to each other like two birds on a wire. It's the most pleasing sound, like sunshine and hope. And for a moment, I wonder what it is I have done to deserve the good fortune of having them both here. My legs gradually regain mobility, and I walk over to the kitchen and stand in the threshold. Thank you, I say. I can't thank you enough for... Mr. Preston interrupts me.
Sugar bowl? I know it must be here somewhere.
In the cupboard beside the stove. First shelf, I say.
Off you go, then. Leave the rest to us.
I turn and head to the bathroom, where I shower quickly, grateful that there's proper hot water today and relieved to scrub the sour filth of the station and court off my skin. I enter the living room a few minutes later in a white, button-down blouse and dark slacks. I'm feeling quite a lot better. Mr. Preston is seated on the sofa, and Charlotte is sitting across from him on a chair she's brought from the kitchen. He's found Gran's beautiful silver serving tray in the cupboard, the one we bought for a most economical sum at a thrift store so long ago. It's so strange to see it in his large masculine hands. The full tea service is expertly arranged on the table in front of the sofa. Where did you learn to serve a proper tea, Mr. Preston?
I wasn't always a doorman, you know. I had to work my way up to that, he says. And to think, I now have a daughter who's a lawyer.
His eyes crinkle up as he looks upon his daughter. It's a look that reminds me so much of Gran. I want to cry.
Shall I pour you a cup?
Mr. Preston asks me. He doesn't wait for an answer.
One lump or two?
It's a two sort of day, I say.
Every day is a two sort of day for me, he says. I need all the sweetness I can get.
Truthfully, so do I. I need the sugar because I'm feeling a tad faint again. I've had nothing to eat since the raisin bran muffin in the station this morning. I don't have enough food in my cupboards to serve three people, and eating on my own would be the very pinnacle of impropriety.
Dad, you've got to cut back on sugar, Charlotte says, shaking her head.
You know it's not good for you.
Ah, well, he replies, hard to teach an old dog new tricks and all. Right, Molly?
He pats his belly and chuckles. Charlotte puts her teacup on the table. She picks up the yellow pad of paper and a sleek gold pen she's placed on the floor beside her chair. So, Molly, have a seat. Are you ready to talk? I'll need you to tell me everything you know about the Blacks and why you think you stand accused of, well, many things.
Wrongly accused, I say, as I take a seat beside Mr. Preston.
That's a given, Molly, Charlotte replies. I'm sorry I didn't make that immediately clear. My father and I wouldn't be here if we didn't believe that. Dad's convinced you had nothing to do with this. He's long suspected there's nefarious activity taking place at that hotel. She pauses and looks around the room. Her eyes land on Gran's flowered curtains, her curio cabinet, and the English landscape prints on the wall.
I can see why Dad's so sure about you, Molly. But to absolve you, we need to figure out who might actually be guilty of these crimes. We both think you've been played. Do you understand? You've been used as a pawn in Mr. Black's murder. I recall the gun in my vacuum. The only people who knew about me and that gun were Giselle and Rodney. That thought alone sends a wave of sadness rushing through me. I slump over as it washes away all the gumption from my spine. I'm innocent, I say. I didn't kill Mr. Black. Tears prick my eyes, and I drive them back. I don't want to make a fool of myself. I really don't.
It's all right, Mr. Preston says, giving my arm a little pat. We believe you. All you have to do is tell the truth, your truth, and Charlotte will see to the rest.
My truth. Yes, I say. I can do that. I suppose it's time.
I start with a full description of what I saw the day I entered the Black suite and found him dead in his bed. Charlotte furiously jots down my every word. I describe the drinks on the messy sitting room table, Giselle's spilled pill bottle in the bedroom, the discarded robe on the floor, the three pillows on the bed rather than four. I start to shake as the memory returns.
I'm not sure that pillows and messiness are the details Charlotte's after here, Molly,
Mr. Preston says.
I think she's looking for details that might suggest foul play.
That's right, Charlotte adds. Such as the pills. You said the pills were Giselle's. Did you touch them? Were they labeled?
No, I didn't touch them. Not that day, at least. And the container wasn't labeled. I knew they were Giselle's because she'd often take them in my presence when I was cleaning the suite. Plus, I often saw the bottle in the bathroom. She called them her Ben's friends or her chill pills. I believe Ben's is a medicine of some sort. She did not seem ill to me, well, not in the physical sense, But some illnesses are a lot like maids. Omnipresent, but almost imperceptible.
Charlotte looks up from her pad.
So true, she says.
Benz is short for benzodiazepine. It's an anti-anxiety and depression med. Small white pills.
A lovely shade of robin's egg blue, actually.
Huh, says Charlotte. So it was a street drug, not a prescription. Dad, did you ever talk to Giselle? Ever see any odd behavior from her?
Odd behavior?
He says, taking a sip of tea.
Odd behavior is par for the course when you're a hotel doorman at the Regency Grand. It was clear that she and Mr. Black were often on the outs. On the day that Mr. Black died, she left in a hurry and was crying. A week before, same thing. But that was after a visit from Victoria, Mr. Black's daughter, and his ex-wife, the first Mrs. Black.
I remember that day, I say. Mrs. Black, the first, held the elevator door open for me, but her daughter told me to take the service elevator instead. Giselle told me Victoria disliked her. Perhaps that's why Giselle was crying that day, Mr. Preston.
Tears and high drama were a rather regular occurrence for Giselle,
Mr. Preston says.
I suppose that's not surprising when you consider the man she married. Far be it from me to wish a man ill, but I was not sad to see that man's life come to an early end.
Why's that? Charlotte asks.
You work a door like the Regency Grand for as long as I have, and you can read people in a single glance. He was no gentleman, not to the new Mrs. Black or to the former Mrs. Black. Mark my words, that man was a bad one.
A bad egg? I ask.
A stinking, rotten egg,
Mr. Preston confirms. Did he have any obvious enemies, Dad? Anyone who might have wanted him conveniently dispatched?
Oh, I'm sure he did. I was one of them. But there were others. First off, there were the women, the other women. When the Mrs. Blacks, new or old, were not around, there were, how should I call them, young female callers.
Dad, just say sex workers.
I would call them that if I knew for sure that's what they were, but I never actually saw money exchange hands. Nor the other part.
Mr. Preston coughs and looks at me.
Sorry, Molly, this is all quite dreadful.
It is, I say. But I can corroborate that. Giselle told me that Mr. Black was engaging in extramarital relations, with more than one woman, too. It hurt Giselle, understandably.
She told you that? Charlotte asks. Did you tell anyone else?
I most certainly did not, I say. I adjust the top button of my blouse. Discretion is our motto. Invisible customer service is our goal.
Charlotte looks at her father.
Mr. Snow's edict for hotel employees, he explains. He's the hotel manager and self-proclaimed Grand Vizier of hotel hospitality and hygiene, but I'm starting to wonder if his Mr. Clean act is all just a clever front.
Molly, Charlotte says, can you tell me anything that might help me understand the drug and weapons charges against you? I can shed some light, I hope. Giselle and I were more than just maid and guest. She trusted me. She shared her secrets with me. She was my friend. I look to Mr. Preston, fearing I'm disappointing him since I crossed a guest-employee boundary, but he doesn't look upset, just concerned. Giselle came to my house the day after Mr. Black died. I didn't tell the police about that. I figured it was a private visit in my own home and therefore none of their concern. She was very upset, and she needed a favor from me. I obliged.
Oh, dear, says Mr. Preston.
Dad, Charlotte says, then to me,
what did she ask you to do?
To remove the handgun she'd hidden in the suite, in the bathroom fan.
Charlotte and Mr. Preston exchange another look, one I'm all too familiar with. They understand something that I don't.
But there weren't any gunshots heard or even reports of wounds on Mr. Black's body, Mr. Preston says. No, not according to any news feeds I've seen, Charlotte replies.
Asphyxiated, I say. That's what Detective Stark said. Charlotte's mouth falls open.
Good to know,
she says, and scribbles something on her yellow pad.
So the gun wasn't the murder weapon. Did you return it to Giselle?
I didn't get the chance. I hid it in my vacuum cleaner, expecting to give it to her later. Then at lunch, I left the hotel.
That's right, says Mr. Preston. I saw you rushing out the doors and was wondering where you were off to in such a hurry.
I look down at the cup in my lap. Something niggles at my conscience. The dragon in my belly stirs. I found Mr. Black's wedding ring, I say, and I pawned it. I know that was wrong. It's just been very hard on my own to make ends meet financially. My gran, she'd be so ashamed of me. I can't bear to look up at either of them. Instead, I just stare into the black hole of my teacup.
Dear girl, Mr. Preston says, your gran understood money troubles better than most. Believe me, I know that much about her and a whole lot more. It's my understanding that she left you some savings after she passed.
Gone, I say. Frittered away. I can't explain about Wilbur and the Fabergé. There's only so much shame I can confess to at once.
So you pawned the ring and then went back to work? Charlotte asks.
Yes.
And the police were waiting for you when you came back?
Mr. Preston steps in.
That's correct, Charlotte. I was there. Couldn't do a damn thing to stop it either, though I tried.
Charlotte shifts her weight in the chair, crosses her legs.
What about the drug charges? Do you understand how those came about?
There were traces of cocaine on my maid's trolley. I have no idea how that's even possible. I promised Gran long ago that I'd never in my life touch a drug. Now I fear I've broken my promise.
Dear girl, Mr. Preston says, I'm sure she didn't mean it literally.
Let's go back to the gun, Charlotte says. How did the police find it in your vacuum cleaner?
And here's where I must confess the pieces that I've put together myself since my arrest. Rodney, I say, choking on the two syllables, barely able to spit them up and eject them from my mouth.
I was wondering when his name would pop up, Mr. Preston says.
When the police talked to me yesterday, I was afraid, very afraid. I went straight home and called Rodney.
He's the bartender at the social, Mr. Preston adds for Charlotte's benefit. Smarmy cretin. Write that down.
It hurts to hear Mr. Preston say it. I called Rodney, I say. I didn't know what else to do. He's been a loyal friend to me. Maybe even a little bit more than a friend. I told him about the police questioning me, about Giselle, and the gun in my vacuum cleaner, and about the ring I'd found and pawned.
Let me guess. Rodney said he'd be all too happy to help a nice girl like you,
says Mr. Preston. Something to that effect, I say. But Detective Stark said it was Cheryl, my supervisor, who followed me to the pawn shop. Maybe she's the culprit in all of this. She's definitely untrustworthy. The stories I could tell you.
My dear Molly, Mr. Preston says with a sigh, Rodney used Cheryl to tip off the police. Can you see that? He's likely used the gun and the ring in your possession to divert suspicion away from himself and toward you. He may very well be connected to the cocaine found on your cart and to the murder of Mr. Black.
I know Gran would be displeased, but my shoulders slump even more. I can barely keep myself upright. Do you think that perhaps Rodney and Giselle are in cahoots? I ask. Mr. Preston nods slowly. I see, I say.
I'm sorry, Molly. I tried to warn you about Rodney,
he says. You did, Mr. Preston. You can add the I told you so. I deserve it.
You do not deserve it, he replies.
We all have our blind spots.
He stands and walks over to Grand's curio cabinet. He looks at the photo of my mother, then puts it down. He picks up the photo of Gran and me at the Olive Garden. He smiles, then returns to his seat on the sofa.
Dad, what exactly did you see at the hotel that made you suspicious of illegal activity? Do you think there's actual drug running happening at the Regency Grand?
No, I say, definitively, before he can answer. The Regency Grand is a clean establishment. Mr. Snow wouldn't have it any other way. The only other issue is Juan Manuel.
Juan Manuel Morales? The dishwasher? Mr. Preston asks.
Yes, I reply. I certainly wouldn't tell tales under ordinary circumstances, but these are far from ordinary circumstances.
Go on, Charlotte says.
Mr. Preston leans forward, adjusting himself around the sofa's pointier springs. I explain everything. How Juan Manuel's work permit expired some time ago, how he has nowhere to live, and how Rodney secretly lets him stay overnight in empty hotel rooms. I explain the overnight bags I drop off, and how I clean up after Juan Manuel and his friends every morning. I'll admit, I say, I really don't know how so much dust can be tracked into a room in just one night. Charlotte puts her pen down on her pad and addresses her father.
Wow, Dad, what a fine establishment you work at.
Par excellence, as they say in France, I add. Mr. Preston has his head in his hands and is shaking it back and forth.
I should have known, he says. The burn marks on Juan Manuel's arms. The way he avoided me whenever I asked how he was doing.
It's only then that the jigsaw pieces connect in my mind. Rodney's behemoth friends. The dust. The parcels and overnight bags. The traces of cocaine on my trolley. Oh, my Lord, I say. Juan Manuel. He's being abused and coerced.
He's being forced to cut drugs every night in the hotel,
Mr. Preston says.
And he's not the only one being used. They've been using you too, Molly.
I try to swallow the enormous lump that has formed in my throat. I see it all clearly. All of it. I haven't only been working as a maid, have I? I ask.
I'm afraid not, Charlotte replies. I'm sorry to say it, Molly, but you've also been working as a mule.
Chapter 19. Charlotte is on the phone having a quiet conversation with someone from her office. Mr. Preston is using the washroom. I'm pacing the living room. I stop at the window and open it a crack in a futile attempt to get some fresh air. Attached to our exterior wall, an empty bird feeder swings in the breeze. Gran and I used to watch birds from this window. We'd admire them for hours as they gobbled breadcrumbs we'd leave out. We gave each little bird a name. Sir Chirps-a-Lot, Lady Wingdemere, and the Earl of Beak. But when Mr. Rosso complained about the noise, we stopped our feeding. The birds flew away and never returned. Oh, to be a bird. As I stare out the window, I catch little snippets of Charlotte's conversation. Background check on Rodney Stiles. Firearms registry for the name Giselle Black. Inspection records for the Regency Grand Hotel. Mr. Preston emerges from the washroom.
No Juan Manuel?
He asks. Not yet, I reply. About an hour ago, Charlotte and Mr. Preston decided to contact Juan Manuel. I was very unsure about dragging him into my mess.
It's the right thing to do, Charlotte said, for many reasons. He holds the missing